We start right out of the gate by getting on board the G&M Family Market phone line and saying hello to Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Bob, good afternoon.
Well, hi there, Rich. Good afternoon to you.
Well, a whirlwind week it's been in Boston sports, and let's start with the Red Sox. A busy couple of days for them at the winter meetings. Dave Dombrowski dealing like, I don't know what they used to say about pitchers who worked fast, dealing like a guy who's double parked.
He operates very forcefully, and he operates in a predictable manner in that he values known commodities over untried, quote-unquote, prospects. And he's done that in three different locations, and he's done it once again. And he landed the prize pitching acquisition of the offseason in Chris Sale. So, but this is how he does business. If you hire him, you know your prospects are going to be used as bargaining chips at least as often as they will be used in your own behalf.
Somewhat overshadowed by all the trading was the fact that they did extend their option on John Farrell for one more season. In the big picture, I'm not sure how much it means, but for the Red Sox at least, it does give them the at least illusion of stability going in.
I like the way you put it. It means that we won't have to have a certain conversation all year next year, and that is good, and it's certainly good for John Farrell. It doesn't mean John Farrell will live to see the end of this contract. Let's get that clear. He'll be able to be he'll be expendable ultimately, and they'll pay him off if they need be. But we won't have this speculation. We won't have this uncertainty. The clubhouse will be stable, and you're not going to convince everybody that John Farrell is a good manager, even though he's got a world championship ring. And that's just the way it is. He's going to be John Farrell. I don't think he's an upper echelon manager, but I don't think he's a bad one either. I think he's somewhere in the middle.
Some other baseball news of note in the last week or so, and let's start with the fact that the All-Star game goes back to being an exhibition game that doesn't have bearing on home field for the World Series. Is that a good move?
It's more than a good thing. It's a very good thing, and it's a logical thing, and it's a step towards sanity. It was just an utter, complete overreaction on the part of Bud Selig to that night when both managers ran out of pitchers in the 2002 All-Star game. And where was the game taking place? In Bud's little playpen in Milwaukee. And he never got over this. And we didn't get over this right away. And he reacted forcefully and stupidly. It never made the slightest bit of sense to have a game that is not played as a normal game is played. With managers really playing to win by playing their best players and having pitchers go longer than one inning and all that, and to have it mean something is ridiculous. And so I think we're back to normal, and I think the solution was the only logical one. No, it was one of two logical ones, not the one I favor, but it's okay. The one I favor would be whoever wins interleague. That's all. Every league, every year, whatever league wins interleague competition, that's their home field advantage. I think that would have been the best way to go. But the way they're going to go with the best record, okay, I'll go with that.
Well, this is a good transition then into the Bud Selig being chosen for the Baseball Hall of Fame. There are other commissioners in there. Bowie Kuhn comes to mind, who I'm not sure what their level of accomplishments were. Happy Chandler, who was certainly there when baseball was integrated. But does Bud Selig belong there from your perspective?
I think there's more pro than con. The two cons are not one of one that he's presided over the steroid era. And people will never, some people again, will never be convinced that he and the people in power didn't know everything and didn't care, as opposed to the idea that we really didn't know the full scope of what was going on. And that includes the media, and that includes myself. I give him a little slack on that regard. Some people aren't willing to do it. The other thing that was pointed out by most notably Murray Chass in his very forceful baseball blog is that Bud, as an owner, was very much involved with the collusion of the 86-87 era, and that he should be held accountable for that. I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think that that fans ever cared about collusion? Because I don't.
No, not at all.
But I don't think it was wrong. It was wrong. But I don't think fans cared, because players ultimately are players who get paid a lot of money to play the game, and people for the most part have limited sympathy players in matters like this. So I don't think that the average fan cared all that much about collusion.
I agree completely on that. Now, Bob, you've always been very public about who you have voted for and who you've chosen not to vote for when it comes to the Hall of Fame ballot. Now, those ballots will be public. Is that a good move?
Well, I think it's a good thing. And here's the, it'll be interesting to see how it affects the steroid guys as people have to stand up and be counted one way or the other publicly, because not everybody has declared how they look at things. The other one is very interesting. Will this finally result in a unanimous selection? Who is going to want to be the person to have to explain to somebody why he didn't vote for Derek Jeter or Mariano Rivera, for example, upcoming? It would have been interesting to hear from the people who didn't vote for Willie Mays and Ted Williams, among others, since there's never been a unanimous pick. Oh, that's going to be interesting. And I think that's maybe the more fascinating aspect of this. I have no problem with it because, as you say, I habitually write a column or at least make it clear who I vote for.
Yesterday was a banner day in the Boston sports history, the 60th birthday of Larry Bird, a man that you said in your book, Scribe, that you have probably written more words about than any other individual. And I love the story. I went back and reread the story of your first meeting, your first encounter with Larry Bird, when he set the boundaries for you pretty clearly.
He did. We were together because I was commissioned to write a piece on him for Us magazine in summer of 70, and the deal was I would meet him at Bob Wolf, his agent's house, not his, and we would do the interview. And Larry was polite, and he did lay down the groundwork. He said that he understood that though he was managed to avoid the media at Indiana State in that senior year, he would fulfill his expected obligations, but that no one would ever come to his house, and he'd never get personal, but he would do his professional job. Well, as time went on, Larry found out that he actually enjoyed the process with the media. And not only did I go to his house, but I wound up doing a book with him. And I wasn't the only person to have social encounter with Larry Bird. But he did. He was wary. I mean, the best word to describe where he was in 1979 was wary of the media. Not hostile, suspicious and wary, but not overtly hostile.
And you have so many highlights that you can think of throughout his great career, but you say that your favorite moment is also Larry's favorite moment, and that would be the night of June 8th, 1986.
Yep. Game 6 against the Rockets, and Larry that day put on a two-way or multiple display of basketball individual talent that I have never seen, and that includes the best of Michael, the best of LeBron. I don't think they've ever played a better game than Larry played that day because he was everywhere on defense, offense. He orchestrated the entire game in a way, and it was just a spectacular performance. And then afterward, he did say that, when we did the book, he said he never was more prepared than that day. Now, that's an amazing statement when you think about Larry Bird and exactly what he meant. I'm not even 100% sure, but he was ready to go that day. And he said, I remember one thing he said, he felt like his heart was beating out of his chest. He was so pumped and excited that day. And yes, that is my favorite Bird game of the many, 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 many great ones.
You saw Russell, you saw Cousy. Has there ever been a more beloved Celtic than Larry Bird?
No. And that's a good point, Rich. He touched fans' emotions. Only Cowens came close. But he was better than Cowens. Fans had an accessibility. There was a with him, and they felt they had one in the way that Cousy did not have, Russell certainly did not want, and Havlicek did not have, and Cowens did not have, and Paul Pierce, McHale, none of them had it the way Larry did. And he played to the crowd and for the crowd as well, and in a way that none of the other great ones did.
Bob, you had dared to suggest last weekend in the Globe that the Patriots are flawed. What's the reaction been from those feverish Pats fans?
They don't want to hear that. You can't win, Rich. If you say you think they're going to go 14-2, that they'll say, well, you're in the bag for Kraft. You're just a cheerleader. You can't win. I think most people understand that the defense is suspect. There was compelling, stunningly compelling statistical evidence put forth in the Boston Herald the other day by Jim Lazar about how suspicious their defense is and how they have been incredibly fortunate to be playing lousy offenses all year and quarterbacks who are on the bottom half of the scale. In the next two games, we will find out how good they really are in both ways, both offensively and defensively, because first they have to play the Ravens with a real quarterback. Flacco is capable of hurting you. And secondly, they're going to go to Denver, and we don't even have to elaborate what that means for the offense. So the next 2 weeks are exams. Up to now, they've just been taking little pop quizzes.
We lost a true American hero today, the passing of John Glenn at age 95. And I'm pretty sure that that you'll know this because I think I remember correctly that during his time in the Korean War, his flight instructor, I believe, was Ted Williams.
Oh, I just heard 5 minutes ago before we got together about the death of Senator Glenn. And yes, the very first thing I thought of was the fact that he was a close friend of Ted Williams. They had flown together in Korea. And so, yes, you're 100% correct. And honest to God, that's the first thing I thought of was Ted Williams. So there you go. Senator Glenn, John, a great American hero. And nobody else can say I was the first man in American in outer space. John Glenn.
And I think it was John Glenn who said, well, I know he's the greatest hitter of all time, but he may also be the greatest pilot of all time.
Well, he was a great pilot. There's no question. He was such a good pilot that in World War II, you know, he wasn't a combat pilot in World War II because he was so good they made him an instructor.
Right.
And then, of course, he was called back in, as a reservist, and he flew, many, many, many missions in Korea and was shot down at once. So, but he was such a phenomenal. His reflexes, his 2015 eyesight, his reflexes, his hand-eye coordination, his intelligence, everything. They said, we need to have him for the greater good, and the greater good for his country in World War II was to be an instructor. And then, of course, in Korea, he went out there in the field, if you will, or up in the sky and did the job.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Bob, always love talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us this afternoon. Hope you and your family have a wonderful Christmas, and we'll catch you in the new year.
Same to you, and hello to everybody up in Maine. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Ryan with us here on Downtown.